Con Ed, I'll just simply change the transformer. And I remember saying to myself, I doubt it. Can you imagine digging up a New York City street, taking a transformer that was, let me pick a number, I think it was a 15-foot cube, maybe it was a 12-foot cube, digging up the street, taking this transformer out of the basement and replacing it with another similar device that probably is going to be $500,000, just to remove some magnetic field that was giving some electronic grief. To make a long story short, the transformer did not get removed. Am I changing the story? Am I losing some of the details of the story, Eric? K2HA, K2LIW. Okay, we're going to go on. As you can tell, John, although your original questioner was asking about electromagnetic pulse, and the electromagnetic pulse made by a solar event, it may be called EMP. I would really call it a kind of an aurora, let's call it a solar plasma sheath. When you get these charged particles at roughly 1,000,000 miles an hour, and if the solar, if the sun decides to burp with a coronal mass expulsion and send billions of pounds of charged particles at 1 or 2 million miles an hour out into space, and as the sun rotates once every 27 days, if it happens to aim that gunshot at the Earth, as the sun has done a few times in the past, then each of your pieces of wire for hours at a time are going to produce some very large voltages for hours at a time. That's very different than a lightning bolt burst, which produces great big chunks of voltage for microseconds. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, he's very young, gentleman that asked this question. He's 14 years old, yeah. So he was considering field density and proximity. So there he's right, but he's missing the function of the solar mass ejection itself. Very good. I'm sure you had a lot of information, plus you learned something about transformers. That's very good. It's after 11. We should go over to Paul for the space report. DC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, we're going to go to Paul so we don't put people to sleep that want to listen to the space report. Although we're not going to go to them right now, my guess is you had at least two more of these real interesting questions from your writers. Is that true, John?
Yes, I have a couple. And I have another short one that we could cover later. But whatever you want to do, Dick.
We're going to go to Paul, and then if there's time left over, we'll consider going to more of your questions, because some of them are damn good. WS2M, what is NASA doing these days? K2LIW, go ahead, Paul. Do a brief transmission and find out how well you're coming through tonight.
Okay, Dick, this is WS2N. I just wanted to concentrate on the upcoming lunar launch to the moon. So copy, Dick.
You sound as good as you ever have, Paul, so please proceed.
Okay, I'm talking about the Lottie Lynch launch that's going up on the 6th of September. It's going to be launched from the Wallops Island. I know I've talked about it before. Wallops Island facility in Virginia. And it's going to be launched by a private corporation called Orbital Sciences. They come out of Dulles and Virginia. And they're the ones that launch all the Pegasus missiles for the last, I don't know, 20 years, or probably more than that. But now they're into private launches. They've got another private launch coming up a couple of weeks from now. They're going to launch the Antares rocket with the Cygnus spacecraft on board to the International Space Station. But for now, they're going to launch the Lottie lunar probe. This thing's going to be a 100-day mission. It's going to take about 30 days to get there. It's going to have an elliptical orbit and eventually solar elliptical that'll to it. They're looking for real science when it comes behind the very rarefied, if you want to call it, atmosphere of the moon. But an interesting experiment that they have on board is something called the it's a laser machine. So it's the LLCD. Now LCD is not a liquid crystal display, but it's the Lunar Laser Communications Demonstration. What they want to do is have two-way communication between Earth and the satellite. But at roughly 20 megabits per second. The goal is to one day allow for a 3D high definition video transmission from deep space, and they want to make it a routine system. You gotta remember, since the first ventures into space, the moon shuttle program, all these unexplored missions to the different planets, RF is the only way to go. And it's kind of like reached its limit because they have more and more data that they want to pass by if they ever want to do, for instance, 3D resolution video transmissions from either the moon or asteroids. They need to increase that bandwidth. And this experiment is going to do that with this laser on board developed by MIT. And hopefully it'll work good. They'll turn it on and off every now and then. And thus, naturally, it goes into the into Earth through the atmosphere. So you need a cloudless type of situation. So you've got your main transmitting and reception in New Mexico, White Sands. What they're going to do is actually transmit up to the satellite too at probably same kind of a board rate. And then you have a receiving station only in Goldstone in case there's problems. And you got another one out in Tenerife out in an island, the biggest island owned by Spain, out in the Canary Islands, that's also involved with this. So somebody will probably be cloudless. They'll detect the spacecraft, they'll zoom in on it, and they're going to see how they do. So that interests me, being a communication. So with that, I know that European Space Agency has successfully transmitted two low Earth orbit satellites using laser. But this big time, they go right to the moon. In fact, the European Space Agency has done it to a geosynchronous orbit, so what's that, 22,000 miles up? This is roughly 10 times that amount to the moon. And eventually they want to go further, you know, into deep space, further than the moon with this laser system. And on a regular basis in the future, they'll actually have satellites going around the Earth, unimpeded by cloud cover, and they'll be able to either download in real time or probably delay time back to our stations on Earth for high bandwidth, high baud rate, really, communication. Let me drop it. That's pretty much one I really wanted to cover. I know we can cover the Falcon 9.1. 1.1 version mission. That's the improved Falcon 9 that's being launched from Vandenberg minutes or five. There's a minutes or one and two. You know, it's quite a size to that, but this one's a lot bigger. And this first lunar launch to the moon by the United States using a different launch facility in Virginia. You know, they've done a lot of launches from Cape Canaveral, from Vandenberg Air Force Base, but this is the first lunar launch and first private company launch of a rocket to put a satellite in lunar orbit. It's roughly a 100-day mission, too. I mean, once it gets there, it'll hang out for about 30 days or so to real science. Back to you, Dick, for any questions, and WS2N, anybody wants to contact me, it's spacenetreport@gmail.com. Dick, over to you.
And a question for Paul, Dick.
Go right ahead, John.
Good evening, Paul. The rock that's following Neptune, or that asteroid, they're confused. Comet, asteroid. Did you read anything about that? Do you have any information on that by any chance?
No, I haven't covered that one at all, John. But I'll look into that. An asteroid that's following it, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, give us some words as to what you discovered and from where, John, go ahead.
Going through the internet, I found a location, and it was like a news flash that they found this, and it was on local TV, too. They found, first they were confused, they didn't know if it was a minor planet or not, but it's in the same orbital path as Neptune. I believe, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Neptune. And they say it will follow it for quite a few years, but then in time it's going to be flung out of our solar system, and it will then just be a wanderer. I just thought Paul may have read something on that. And Dick, by the way, did you get the article I sent you about the new element, short-lived element that they located?
Yes, I remember that was element number 115 on Pentium or something like they called it. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes, I was wondering if that is an element, one of the ones they predicted in the periodic table that they fit in there. That information wasn't there.
I know that the elements above approximately element number 100 in the past are usually very short-lived, not very stable. When you pack, I mean, the element number is the number of protons in that nucleus. When you start getting above 100 protons, and each of these protons are extremely heavily positive charged, and therefore the electrostatic repulsion of each of them is huge. And can the strong force inside the nucleus hold that together? And some of these things are really, you don't want to be there, and they come flying out of there. And so, I've forgotten, but element number 115, did they say it was stable? There's probably multiple isotopes of it. In other words, by having more or less number of neutrons along with 115 protons, it's still element 115. But I guarantee you each of the variants of that, what's the word I'm looking for? I've already forgotten the word. When you got more or less protons, are all of them stable? I've forgotten those details. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
From what I read, I considered it an unstable, just from the fact that it was such a short-life element. That's usually indication of it being unstable. But I was just wondering if you had noticed anything about that. And it was one of the points I wanted to bring up about it. Tough to get old. Anyway, I'll pass it back to you right now, Dick.
And my guess is that it was a particle accelerator or something like that that was used to produce this element that is not something that is naturally produced by Mother Nature. And if Mother Nature did produce them, because the half-life is so short, I don't think we'd find any of it sitting around. So I think this is an artificially generated element. Is that true, John?
Well, they said they discovered a new element. Not that that they created it, so I thought maybe in one of these accelerators that showed up in a photograph, maybe a trace that they didn't recognize and had to assign that to some new quality.
Now, many of these elements are called discovery, Einsteinium, and Berkelium, and whatever, named after a person or a location where it was first recognized, and you call that a discovery when you recognize it. But it is an event inside of a particle accelerator that created it. With rare exception, you don't put Mother Nature's natural elements into a cloud chamber. That's one of the detectors that's used. The cloud chamber is the thing that you quite often hang on the tail end of a target area of a particle accelerator. So an awful lot of these discoveries are really creation slash discovery, I think, as opposed to somebody taking out his pickaxe in a salt mine somewhere, and he looks at this funny colored rock and figures out what it is. I think that's not where it's coming from. That's a guess. Anyway, in the case of the Lunar Laser LADEE, the latest issue of IEEE Spectrum, if you're a member of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers and you get their monthly magazine called IEEE Spectrum, the September issue, that's got a nice picture of the moon, and the article there is, it's one of the lead articles labeled Longest Laser Link Set for Moon Launch. An experiment aboard NASA's LADEE, L-A-D-E-E, Orbiter, will put deep space laser communication to the test. That's what's in that article. So, unfortunately, let me drop. There is a website that you can go to that's got it. And whether or not that website is open to non-IEEE members, I'm not sure. Unfortunately, the URL is a very long one. But interesting looking article, and because of that great focusing capability of a laser, it's a very attractive thing to use for long range space communication. So that's part of what I think this high speed communication LADEE is going to be doing. And so I'm guessing it's going to attempt to break brand new records of bit rate of data and miles. So if as my criteria for quality is the product of miles and instantaneous bandwidth, how many bits per second or how many megabits or gigabits per second can you send, and how many kilometers or miles are you doing it over, and you take the product of those, I think this is going to break some brand new records along those lines. Is that approximately what you got out of the article, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW, the TechNet?
Yeah, that's talking about 20 megabits, 20 megabits, 20 million bits per second, that's the one number that I read about. And as far as bit transmission rate, RF, they said, is 1/6 of that, so you might know the capabilities of RF, Dick, as far as bit capability, of a quarter of a million miles, but this thing's going to be six times that with less power, 25% less power than what an RF amplifier would be putting out. That's what I read.
That makes a lot of sense. When you're in space and you're not experiencing any atmospheric absorption and precipitation problems and so on, the higher the frequency, the better. Because by the laws of physics, your fixed-sized aperture of the transmitter and fixed-sized aperture of the receiver, whether it be horn, parabolic dish, or the front end of a laser, in either case, as you go to higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths, the same number of inches of aperture is going to give you a more pencil beam, sharper signal, all being transmitted in the right direction. So as long as you can achieve the aiming accuracy requirement, the higher the frequency, the better. That's why, let me drop. tell you, whenever I write these emails to the Tom Williams WA1MBA microwave reflector, I quite often put a little statement on the bottom. No frequency is too high, or no frequency is high enough. I put either one of those statements from time to time. And I've recently had a great big multi-page article that I submitted to those people on the subject of proper use of satellite receiving dish. The 18-inch diameter dish for DSS service, direct satellite service, something in the vicinity of 20 million of those have been produced in the last decade or so for worldwide television satellite reception. That design was done by Dave McGee, a ham radio operator at the Princeton location of RCA Istro. I'm not sure of the exact year, but I'm guessing it was somewhere around 1985, 1988 that he did that. And very few people know of that work. He didn't invent the offset-fed parabolic antenna, but he did take the concept of the offset-fed parabolic antenna and generate an extremely well-designed version that is very easy to make a stamping of it. I mean, under normal circumstances, a 12 gigahertz Ku-band satellite receiving dish would be, let me pick a number, $1,000 worth of hardware. Let me drop it. That particular design, it's got a long enough focal length, a flat enough dish, high enough performance, that millions and millions of these things were made, something in the vicinity of 20 million of them. And we amateur radio operators, when you want to operate the 10 gig, 24 gig, 47 gig ham bands, that's a very desirable antenna. To buy it for numbers like $12 and then convert it to your ham radio operation, you're getting a lot for the money. And so Dave McGee is the unsung hero. W2KV, I think it says, call letters. I may have the call letters wrong. N3AHV, I think it was his call letters before he recently changed them. So very few people know where that design came from. Very similar to cell phones. There's something like 6 million cell phones in use. And the majority of the invention of the cell phone was done by Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, while at Bell Laboratories in New Jersey. And he was doing that work in 1969. And I was talking to him at the time because he was one of the popular guys on 432 megahertz. And we considered 432 megahertz way back in 1969 as so high in frequency that you almost got a nosebleed. And nowadays it's considered a old hat. It turns out that Dr. Tom Williams, let me drop this. Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, the guy who originally held the domestic distance record for the 120 gig, 2 gig ham band. Brian Justin, WA1ZMS, I think it's called it, he holds the distance record for the 243 gigahertz ham band. But Tom holds the distance record on 120. And what Tom's about to do at the next microwave update, it's going to take place in Kentucky in this coming October, he's going to attempt moon bounce on 87 gigahertz, 85, 87, I think it is, gigahertz, by using the 21-meter diameter radio telescope that's at that university in Kentucky where this next microwave update event's going to take place. And you remember last week a poll was asking me, why in the world are they only using half a watt? Because this is all homebrew equipment, and they've already done a heroic effort to get a half a watt out of 87 gigahertz. Ain't easy. But in October, they're going to make an attempt to do moon bounce at 87 gigs with that dish. Does the dish have enough accuracy? Can they aim it enough? They're going to have something like a 0.012 degree beam width out of that dish on that frequency. And how good is the moon echo going to be? And in theory, the dish is so darn big, the beam width is so small, that when they're doing the illumination of the moon, they're only going to be lighting up a chunk of moon that's 150 miles in diameter. The moon is something like 2,000 miles. 100 miles in diameter, and only 150-mile diameter is going to be lit up with the dish. So as you aim this dish at various spots in the moon, let me drop it. They're hoping to find a chunk of moon that acts like a corner reflector and gives them a great big echo. And they're going to be using a receiver that has a processing network very similar to what John owns, KC2WGB. He owns this beautiful piece of electronics called a dynamic signal analyzer. Hewlett Packard 3571. Is that the right model number on that dynamic signal analyzer, John, a quick break?
61A, I believe it is, Dick.
Okay, the dynamic signal analyzer, Hewlett Packard 3561A, one of my favorite machines. You know what a waterfall display looks like. If you've probably seen a few of them, there's a computer program where you can get a waterfall display, and it looks at a certain number of kilohertz simultaneously across the handband. That dynamic signal analyzer will display 100 kilohertz of instantaneous bandwidth and find all the weak signals that are sitting in the noise across the 100 KC. That's the exact machine that Tom Williams is going to be using in order to find the echo from the moon. Because the moon is in an elliptical orbit and sometimes gets closer and further from the Earth, and because Tom is going to be in Kentucky on the surface of the Earth, and the Earth rotates 15 degrees per hour. So you are moving closer and further from the moon, as long as you're not doing it at high noon on the moon, so to speak. So you're on a moving, rotating Earth. The moon itself is moving closer and further from the Earth because of its elliptical orbit. When you're on 87 gigahertz, they're going to be getting a rough calculation of 100 kilohertz of Doppler shift continuously just because of the velocity equivalent between the transmitter, the moon echo, and back to the receiver, which is the same dish. So you're looking for a super weak signal somewhere in 100 kilohertz of bandwidth. They're going to be using a 3561 to look for the echo, John. It's quite an experiment. I give them a 50-50 chance of success. Smart guys doing it. The best state-of-the-art stuff they can get their hands on without spending megabucks. And it'll be a brand new record. Right now, the highest frequency that has been used...
Repeater, timeout.
The highest frequency that has been used by amateur radio operators for moon rounds, I know that they've done it on 24 gigs. I'm not sure whether or not they've done it on 47 gigs. And the next handband up is roughly 80 gigs. So Tom Williams is going to be making this 78 gig, 80 gig, I'm not sure the exact number, is the next handband where they're going to be making this attempt this coming October. So stay tuned. One other interesting thing I want you guys to look up, which I discovered this week. Let me drop.
KC2IS, query.
Okay, Bill recognized. Get to you in a second. One other thing I want you guys to look up is, here it is. Just Google these words or go to YouTube and look for these words. World's roundest object. World's roundest object. And this is a real mind blower. The world's roundest object is a chunk of silicon. But what a chunk of silicon. They spent 1 million pounds just buying the raw material. 1 million pounds buys them a chunk of silicon, which is probably roughly a 4 or 4.5 inch cube. It's not a cube, but it's one of these carefully built chunks of silicon where you slowly draw it out of the melt. With a seed, and you get this chunk of silicon, which in theory doesn't have a single flaw. In other words, it's a single crystal of silicon. I'm going to make a guess it's a couple of pounds of it. And they spent 1 million euros just buying the raw material. You could say they spent almost that much again making it into a round sphere. The round sphere they made is the roundest object on planet Earth. And the reason they did this is that when you make a round sphere of single crystal silicon, flawless it has a mass of exactly 1 kilogram. They're working on a new definition of the kilogram. Rather than have this sample of a piece of platinum sitting in a vault in France as the standard kilogram for planet Earth, to use as a standard a physical object where every 2 or 3 decades you remeasure it and you come up with a new weight. That is the standard for the kilogram, which in turn, in the SI unit system, allows you to devise 3 or 4 other standards. But that's the base of the head of the building, so to speak, the base of the whole SI system. So by coming up with this substitute for the kilogram, which is this super round chunk of silicon, the advantage is that it now, by way of Avogadro's number, is a very fixed number of silicon atoms, and that will be the mass of 1 kilogram. And now it's not a physical object, it's just a chunk of silicon that anybody can build if you're willing to spend the effort and make it round enough that when you've got 2.15, 10 to the 25, I think it is, atoms of silicon, it will have the mass of exactly 1 kilogram. So therefore, anybody can build one. And the reason they put such a huge effort to make it so round, let me drop, is because when it's perfectly round, and you know its diameter, measured with a laser ranging device, laser diameter measuring device, because you know the formula, we all know that the volume of the sphere is 4/3 pi r cubed. Well, it's also pi over 6 diameter cubed. Same formula with a slight rearrangement. So once you build yourself a silicon sphere that's round enough and smooth enough, you then can recreate, wherever you are on planet Earth, you can recreate the standard kilogram. It's now a concept instead of a physical object in theory. They're moving in that direction. And when you go to that article, you'll see a very nicely built article describing this. And the tricky thing, by the way, the roundness of this 3.6-inch diameter sphere, which weighs exactly 1 kilogram, the roundness of it, the accuracy they've measured, is such that if you blew it up to the size of the Earth, the highest mountain, the deepest valley on the Earth, would only be 14 meters apart on an Earth that's 8,000 miles in diameter. So it is smooth. The tricky thing about calling it the smoothest object on Earth is that there is a smoother object, but it's not on Earth. And it's something that Paul probably described to us once before. It's called the Gravity Probe B. Gravity Probe Bravo. This satellite that was put up in, I think it was 2005. It was put up in 2005, and it was supposed to reconfirm one of Einstein's theories about the way the frame gets dragged. When you've got a satellite in orbit around the Earth, the timing gets...
Repeater, time out.
I think you're basically saying that the speed of light going around the Earth clockwise and the speed of light going around the Earth counterclockwise is two very slightly different numbers. And in order to confirm this, they have to make a pair of spherical objects that are smoother than the roundest object on planet Earth. So there's a slightly rounder object that was put into these two satellites as a gyroscope. So it is smoother yet, but it's about the size of a golf ball, this super smooth gyroscope, looking for this very gentle phenomena of frame dragging. And I don't know the exact number, but I think it would be something like a couple of centimeters of difference would be the highest peak and the lowest valley if you blew it up to the size of the Earth. So there is a smoother object that was built with great difficulty, but it's not on planet Earth. It's in a polar orbit around the north and south pole of planet Earth. This is a one-year project. So, Bill, you got a question about any of the above. AC2IS, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Thank you.
5, but I heard you all on 375. For some reason, that strength of audio, strength of RF or whatever, you were coming out of 375 continuously, only out of 85 a part of the time. Back in the days when a good ham radio tube was an 807, it did a beautiful job on 80 meters. 807s, when you use them on 20 meters, you got quite a bit less power output. Some of it was inter-electrode capacitance inside the tube. Some of it was the inter-electrode capacitance of the socket. And there were people trying to get a little bit more power output from the 807. This is way back in 1935, numbers like that. They were getting a little more power output from the 807 tool by removing the socket, just directly connecting to the wires coming out of the bottom of the glass envelope. All vacuum tubes fall off in gain and power output as you go to higher frequency. One of the factors as to the fall off is called transit time loading. That control grid, let me drop. That control grid, as you put an RF signal on it, is trying to, at the time the control grid is negative, it's trying to repel those electrons that want to boil off the cathode and so stay there. The time that the instantaneous voltage on the control grid is positive, it is sucking electrons off that cathode and say, don't stop here, keep right on going, go on over to the plate. So your control grid is a bulk modulator of the number of electrons leaving that cathode aiming for the plate. However, as you go to higher and higher frequencies, because there is a finite length between the cathode and the grid and the cathode and the plate, as you go to a high enough frequency, the positive charge instant of time of your control grid has told the electrons, come on out of the cathode, get moving. But because the frequency is so damn high, that by the time the electrons leave the cathode and get into the vicinity of the grid, the next half of the cycle is already happening because you're so high, and therefore the electrons come off the cathode, move toward the control grid. By the time they get there, the control grid has now got a negative voltage and is pushing them back to the cathode. That's called transit time loading. The way you see it from the outside of the tube, let me drop, is that what you think is a finite amount of capacitance of the control grid, the cathode, or the tube, and you're resonating that control grid because you're feeding it at, let me pick a number, 50 megacycles, and you know how many picofarads of capacitance you've got between the control grid and the cathode, and you put the right inductor in the right vicinity, so you're resonating that control grid. So the control grid is on the right frequency. You've resonated it with your outside external tuning network. That's the good news. But because of the transit time loading effect, where the positive incident of the voltage you put on the control grid is so brief, and the electrons get a chance to move and then get pushed back again, the transit time loading effect means that if you used your vector network analyzer on the control grid, it suddenly realizes a brand new resistor there. You're using the tube at 80 meters, that resistor looks like 5,000 ohms. You use that tube at 50 megacycles, and the 5,000 ohm resistor is now going down to 13 ohms. I'm picking numbers out of the air to make the concept. So the transit time loading effect makes it look like there's a great big loading resistor there, and therefore you've got to produce a hell of a lot more power to drive that control grid to try to get gain out of the tube. That's the primary effect. The secondary effect is, let me drop, because you're repelling that some of those electrons that you told to come, and before they get there, you tell them to go back, the total number of bulked electrons, these bundles of electrons that you want to be hitting the plate, making a great big RF voltage out of the plate, fewer and fewer electrons get through that gamut that you just created, and therefore the power output of the tube goes down. So I just showed you the mechanisms by which you get a lot more grid loading, a lot less plate power output, and a lot less gain out of a vacuum tube as you go to higher and higher frequencies. So every vacuum tube has got a maximum frequency beyond which you say, forget it. You take the closest possible spacing, like you've got in a 2C39 tube, where the spacing between that control grid and the cathode is probably a fraction of a thousandth of an inch. and the anode, you've moved it as close as you can get. So the 2C39-2, when you've done everything just right, you can sort of get reasonable gain out of it at 1296. By the time you get to 2 gigs, boy, it's falling off in gain real fast. By way of negative grid ordinary vacuum tubes, I think you can safely say, no matter how small you make it, no matter how close you make the spacing, I think there is essentially no conventional vacuum tube that can get you on the 10 gig ham band. They've run out of steam a long time before you get there. Okay, I've given you the phenomenon. Let me drop. I've given you the phenomenon with reference to a vacuum tube because it's a little bit easier to visualize. In the case of a bipolar transistor or a FET transistor, there is a similar phenomenon going on. Call it transit time loading, but I'm sure that the solid state people have got a fancier name for it. So as you go to higher and higher frequencies, to get the same amount of gain, to get the same power output, becomes more and more difficult, and the difficulty goes up by approximately square law of frequency. If you look at the gain fall off of a vacuum tube versus frequency, it's approximately a square law curve. And the physics of what you're doing is going to really fight you on this one now, Bill. That's the reason why a traveling wave tube gets its gain from an entirely different phenomenon. AC2IS, I wonder if that helps. K2IWM TechNet.
Connected if I had a few seconds to do that.
Not required. You're in a good location now. The trap I think you fell into is that you moved around until the reception was good, and you assumed that would be a good place to transmit. You've got a good transmit location now. Okay. Many of the software-defined radios are using a sampling technique. They take some number of samples per second of amplitude, and in some cases they make a sample of I and Q, in phase and in quadrature, at some sampling rate. You might choose a sine wave of 10 megacycles to dictate your sampling, and you're generating two sine waves that are 90 degrees out of phase with each other. When you go through zero crossing on the positive sense, on the first sine wave, you're in phase, you take a sample at that instant. And when you go through zero crossing on the quadrature sine wave, when it goes through zero, you take a sample at that instant. So you're taking samples 90 degrees out of phase with each other, and you're measuring positive and negative voltage on the sample, and you're looking at these two samples per cycle that are 90 degrees apart in phase. When you've got an I and Q detecting system, like I'm just describing, that sampling network allows you to thoroughly reproduce the original signal very nicely. But like everything else, it runs out of steam. Depending on what duration the sample of your sampling network takes a sample, let me drop. If this is the most ideal sampling network in the world, it would take a sample for a duration of not a nanosecond, maybe a picosecond or a fraction of a picosecond would be the sample duration. And if your network can fly fast enough, it'd like to take a billion samples per second. So you're sampling at a gigahertz rate with samples that are lasting a picosecond each. If you can design electronics that can do that, you could easily make electronics that would be able to display a spectrum that's close to 1,000 megacycles wide. Well, now that particular sample that I described, it's a very brief sample at a very high sample rate, but how many bits of amplitude resolution does it have? Does it have 2 bits or 14 bits? And if you now try to combine it all, you want the highest possible fidelity so you can look at the smallest amount of details of the modulation of your raw signal, and you want to have 14 bits of sampling at a billion samples per second, a gigahertz sample rate. Now, those words roll off the tongue real easily. To produce hardware that can do that, it's going to keep you very busy for a long time. So every chunk of electronics has got a frequency beyond which, forget it. It just says, you're wasting your time. We ain't going to get there. Not with this technology. Now, could you take your raw signal and beat it down to a lower frequency by way of superheterodyne so that now your sampling network can do high fidelity sampling at that lower frequency of the raw signal? Absolutely. So, if you're willing to do a whole bunch of mixers where the IF frequency is, let me pick a number, 10 megacycles wide.
Repeater, timeout.
So, one mixer is looking at 100 megs to 110 megs and beating it down to 10 megs. The next mixer is taking 110 to 120 megs and beating it down to 10 megs. And the next mixer is taking 120 to 130 megs and beating it down to 10 megs. And now you've got all of these sampling networks working on each of those individual 10 meg IFs. And if you're smart enough with the way you do the computer programming, you can put it all back together again. However, if your particular sampling rate can't go beyond the frequency of 10 megs, and if your sampling duration can't be brief enough, by way of heterodyne, are you going to get higher instantaneous bandwidth? I think the answer is almost no. If you're willing to build a whole lot of parallel hardware, yes, you can force greater instantaneous bandwidth. But mixing alone gets you to a lower freq, and in some cases that allows your sampling network to work better. But rarely is that going to give you more bandwidth in one single mixer. That's a bunch of opinions, Bill. ACQIS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. Follow-up question here. Would it be possible to build a mixer, I'm not sure if I'm using these terms correctly, that would beat down, say, 100 megahertz to 120 megahertz to an IF that was 0 to 10 megahertz?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can do that. I could, if I wanted to right now, buy a mixer that would take a 15 gigahertz signal, 14 gigs to 15 gigs, and beat it down to an IF of 0 to 1 gig. There are mixers that will do that for you, and they're not very expensive, by the way. Why am I trying? Having trouble thinking of a brand name right now. But I've used mixers like that. So mixers can take significant amounts of RF bandwidth, and if you buy the right brand of mixer and use it correctly, you can get a whole lot of IF bandwidth out of it, out of a doubly balanced mixer. Over to you, Bill.
Okay, thanks, Dick. And then the next follow-up question is, if I'm looking at an existing design that includes the sampling system and the mixers and so forth, and that entire system goes for a price of, say, $400. This other mixer that would be able to compress, you know, 20 megahertz worth of signal down into a 10 megahertz for, you know, hypothetically 10 megahertz IF, what would that cost compared to that $400?
Now, there's a slight problem here, Bill. You use the word compress. With rare exception, a mixer does not compress. It translates. If your mixer has an IF system on it, the IF port of the three ports on the mixer, RF, LO, and IF, if the IF port of your particular mixer has, let me pick a number, 10 megacycles of bandwidth, then you can take RF frequencies, in many cases, maybe as low as 100 megs and as high as 15 gigahertz of RF frequency, and take a 10 meg chunk of it and translate it down to 0 to 10 megs. But that's not compression, that's translation. So maybe we've got a little bit of a vocabulary problem here. Back to you, Bill.
I'll go with that being a vocabulary problem. Not familiar with these terms too much. But again, the question is, what would a mixer like that cost compared to the existing system where the total cost of mixers and sampling and so forth is around $400?
Among the microwave enthusiasts, you can buy doubly balanced mixers. Why can't I think of a brand name right now? Ferenc Marki is one of the guys producing them. Can't think of the brand name. Anyhow, you can buy mixers on the surplus market for ham radio use, sometime for numbers like $25 and $30.
Microline, Dick.
Say it again.
Microline.
That's one of a number of brand names. That's not the one I was trying to think of, but that's certainly. You Google the word doubly balanced mixer, you're going to find a whole lot of brand names. Mini circuits, for instance, make some very inexpensive doubly balanced mixers. I don't think any of the mixers made by mini circuits cost more than $20 in that ballpark. And some of them go to a couple of gigahertz of RF and LO, and some of them go to hundreds of megahertz of instantaneous bandwidth of the IF port, DC to hundreds of megacycles. So the mixer, if you're crafty enough to buy it from the right place, the mixer is, by your and my standards, Bill, relatively inexpensive. So that gives you the ability to start off with a rather high RF frequency, many gigahertz in some cases, and bring it down to DC to 10 megs, if that's what you want to do, as long as you got the right LO to mix with it. And so, if you're sampling electronics, let me drop. If you're sampling electronics running at the lower frequency, it becomes a hell of a lot cheaper for the same bandwidth, and you put a $10 mixer in front of it, as I see it, that's a very good trade-off. Over to you, Bill.
I believe around 30 megahertz to 6 gigahertz. Uses a number of different parts on the mixing side in order to get that range. And I'm wondering what you think the odds might be of those existing mixers being somehow reconfigurable to translate in this fashion.
The time is 12 a.m. 73 and good night from the WQVL repeater.
This is AC2IS, nothing heard.
AC2IS, the machine is timed out because it's midnight. So most doubly balanced mixers are very easy to move the RF and LO frequency, Bill. So that's not much of a problem. So the doubly balanced mixer, when it comes to super high frequencies, bringing them down to low frequencies for your use, you got it made. So that could save you a lot of money. What you guys heard was Technet number 1,464 of the series that began in September of 1982, 31 years ago, 73 years old. And if you're able to get into the Eastern input, you'd be able to say your final words, John, if you want to. KC2WGB, I buy you all, be kind to each other. K2RAW clear, you got it, John. Okay, very good.
I think I'm making it in there. But I just want to thank everybody for participating in the net. And welcome. Come back next week. We should be here. Everybody have a great time. Good night, Dick. Great. AC2WGB. Paul, good evening.
V3ZTZ info.
I'll get you in a minute there, ZTZ, Scott. And we've almost answered everybody's questions. John, so it must dry up and go away. There's almost no questions left, right? That was a big joke. Scott, D3ZTZ, K2LAW with your info. You got it, Scott.
Well, thank you very much. And first, for another great net, you're listening. Additional information on the homebrewed SDRs, two sites, if that gentleman's ready to listen and possibly write down. One is edis.com. US.com makes some really interesting software-defined radio hardware that runs on open-source software.